Interstate Batteries has been a proud supporter of the Sportsman's Nation since day one. With over 200,000 locations throughout the U.S. and offering 12,000 different types of batteries, stop into your local Interstate Battery store today and let them help you find the right batteries for your everyday life.
God, I mean, I've never seen a bear on my property. But it's my dream to one day see a bear on the property, just walking right through the backyard.
You should start putting some food out for him.
He's the one who doesn't like me.
He's converted.
It didn't take much.
Yeah, man, I'm weak. You converted me right away.
No, that's a lot of people. A lot of people don't understand baiting. Like they have this. It's kind of a. You know, it's like, is it fair? And that's really not the right question. Because if the macro concern is the health of wildlife and their how they live inside of habitat, then we have to go back to what's the best management tool for this resource. Mm-hmm. And then once you actually start baiting bears, you realize how hard it is. I believe that bears are going to be the gateway to the hunting community. And so if we guard that gate, they're never going to get anything else. My name is Clay Newcomb, and I'm the host of the Bear Hunting Magazine podcast. I'll also be your host into the world of hunting the icon of North American wilderness, the bear. We'll talk about tactics, gear, conservation, but we'll also bring you into some of the wildest country on the planet chasing bear. We had the opportunity to sit down with James Brandenburg, the Arkansas State Chair of the Southeast Chapter of the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers Organization at the global headquarters. And we had an incredible conversation about some of the tough issues and tough questions related to large predator hunting and specifically baiting and using hounds for bear. James is a newer hunter. And we had a really open dialogue about some of the questions that he's had and undoubtedly some of the questions that other hunters and non-hunters might have had. One of the iconic phrases that came up inside of this podcast is the idea that bear hunting is the gate for the anti-hunting community to come into the sphere of hunting. Why wouldn't we want a strong gate with a strong narrative, with a strong understanding throughout the hunting community of why we do the things that we do and how we do it? I think sometimes in the broader hunting community, there's a sense that people would just like us to give this to the anti-hunting community because they don't understand it. And it's probably one of the harder things about modern hunting to understand. Well, if bear hunting, using hounds and bait was not the gate, then the next lowest rung on the ladder would be the gate, and we'd be in the same problem. So the answer is to strengthen the gate. That's what we talk about on this podcast, is filling in the gaps, building a strong narrative that makes sense and shows the rational aspects, also the traditional aspects, and all the positive benefits of bear hunting. If you're in the southeastern United States, in Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, or Florida, Alabama, check out the Southeast Chapter of the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. This group is dedicated to the preservation of access for hunters and anglers onto public lands. Public lands have typically been an issue that's been related to mostly public land in the West, or historically, that's been where we think about these issues being, but the Southeast is full of public land. As a matter of fact, Florida, I think, has some of the most public land of any state in the country. So we've got issues here in the Southeast. Check out the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Welcome to the Bear Hunting Magazine podcast. The day is June the 4th. Is it June the 4th?
I believe so.
June the 4th. We're at the Bear Hunting Magazine Global Headquarters. So we've got Jed here, Jed the Plot Hound. We've got Colby the Bear Tech. And our guest today is James Brandenburg. James, I'll give a short introduction of how I know you. And then I'll turn it over to you a little bit to tell us a little bit about yourself. But so James is a native Arkansan. The way I know you is through Backcountry Hunters and Anglers.
Yep.
So James is the lead here in Arkansas.
Yep. For state chair now.
State chair. Okay, so it's official.
Yep.
At the time we got to know each other, there really wasn't a state chair.
Right.
But yeah, so James is with Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Aside from being a father and husband and hunter and golfer and, you know.
And fisherman.
Fisherman, yeah. So before we get into you, I want to tell people what we're going to talk about. Just catch them right at first, because there may be some delay before we talk about this.
Okay, yep.
But so James and I have been talking, and we thought it'd be a good idea. Well, James is the one that actually had the idea, but to have a podcast where we talked about many of the misconceptions about bear hunting.
Yeah.
And so James is, I'm not going to say you're new to hunting. I don't know if that would be accurate, but you didn't grow up with specifically bear hunting.
Oh, definitely not. Definitely.
Yeah. And so there's somebody who's new to it, doesn't understand it. There are a lot of questions that people might have specifically about running bear with hounds, hunting bear over bait.
Yep.
I mean, I'm not afraid to say that those things are hard to understand. It's the thing that even many hunters don't understand. And so we're going to have a discussion about these things today.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, from my perspective, my background, grew up Northwest Arkansas. As we've talked about, you know, it was mostly my outdoor activity was golf. I did not start.
You'll be the first golfer on the show.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Well, I love being distinct in some way.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't actually start hunting until I was trying to do the math on this on the way down here. I think it was 8 or 9 years ago.
Okay.
So I've got three boys. My oldest will turn 19. Then I have a 17-year-old, or he'll be 17, and my youngest will be 14.
Right.
This summer. So, first one was interested in hunting. So I thought, well, I might as well at least get my hunter safety card, and then I can buy a license. I can take him out.
Okay. So at this time, you weren't interested in hunting.
I mean, I was a little bit curious about it, but not. I was much more interested in fishing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I started that not too long before that. I started fly fishing, and I really got hooked on that to start off with.
Pun
intended? I did not intend the pun. I'm very sorry about that. No, so I started with that, and that was kind of my introduction into things outside besides sports.
So your kids brought you into hunting?
Yeah, yeah. That's very opposite very of everybody else.
Yep. It's pretty cool.
Okay.
So I went through all kinds of things with them, and we won't go into all of that, but that's how I got started with hunting. Now, up in Missouri, you know, I know down here in Arkansas, for example, let's just talk about deer hunting for a minute. You can bait down here.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, in Missouri, you don't bait. And so a lot of what informed my early ethics around hunting just had to do with the regulations for where I was hunting.
Right.
So then I started hearing, even though I lived in Arkansas, we hunted in Missouri. That's where my in-laws live. I should spell that part out too.
Got it.
So we went to where my in-laws lived and hunted up there. It's close to where we live. So those rules are what informed my own personal ethics. And so I would kind of like, well, why would you, I mean, baiting is bad, right? And I hear about it in Arkansas. I'm like, well, I kind of look down my nose on it a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, for why, I don't know. I mean, geez, I've only been hunting a couple of years. Who am I to tell somebody else, right? But then as I've gotten more and more involved in hunting and started to be exposed to different things, on the one hand, I've kind of realized, okay, there's different ways to do it in different places, and maybe one's not necessarily worse than the other, but there's also these other things that I think I do feel still like a new hunter. And so there's these different ideals that I come to, and I'm like, I think it's worth
having. These are probably questions that a lot of people have.
Yeah, yeah. Sure. I think a lot of people, if you don't know bear hunting, for example, you might wonder, why do they have to use dogs? Why do they have to use bait? That doesn't seem fair. And yep. And so I want to interview you. I mean, we're going to turn the tables. You know, I want to ask you those questions, and not my intention to be confrontational, but I'm going to kind of play devil's advocate for a minute.
Yeah.
And hopefully we can kind of give people on both sides right. something to think about. I think just talking about that stuff and discussing it openly is a better way to do it rather than getting on Facebook and arguing about it. And
right.
you don't know somebody on the other side right. of the screen. You have no idea what they're about. You know, let's just talk about it openly. And
I
agree.
Think inside of conversation like this, you really do create the thoughts, the ethics, the narrative, the way that you say things kind of gets formulated in a formal conversation like this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we'll probably say a lot of things that probably a lot of bear hunters that have done this their whole life would understand. They'd be like, yeah, that's just the way that,
mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it hopefully will, I mean, I don't know what you're going to ask me. So I hope we come to some good conclusions here of ways to think about this stuff, because there is an answer. I mean, if the answer was we're just guys that are just trying to find the easiest way out to kill an animal, and we're just lazy, and we don't enjoy chat. I mean, if like all the negative stereotypes are true, then we're just dirt balls. So there's got to be a way of looking at it that makes sense. And the way that I've always said it is that I believe that if we could remove ourselves from this planet and go to another place that was 100% just in some standard of, you know, justness, and you could present the case for hunting large predators based upon the world that we'd come from, because we're not there anymore, I think we'd win. I mean, it's rational. It makes sense. It's sustainable. It's there's all these positive things, and the negative things oftentimes are not as rational. They're emotional, and they really aren't totally based in fact. That being said, nothing's perfect.
Yeah.
Like, there are bad people that bait bears and run hounds.
Well, there's bad people in everything. I mean,
bad people that play tennis.
Yeah, yes, and golf.
Oh, golf.
I wasn't going to say that one.
You know what's funny? We keep going back to this golf thing. I've told you this. I despised golf as a kid,
yep.
and my dad pushed me to be a golfer, and I was like, no, I'm not a golfer. So don't bring up golf. No, I'm just kidding. Well, hey, I think that's a good introduction just for people that have listened like the first 6 or 7 minutes of the podcast.
Yep.
Let's talk, before we dive into all that though, let's talk about backcountry hunters and anglers. Just give even if we just talk for a short period of time here about it, like describe what backcountry hunters and anglers is from even just like a national perspective.
Okay.
And then what's happening here in Arkansas.
Yep. BHA is the voice for wild public land, public water, and wildlife in North America. That's the tagline. Mm. And, you know, when we think about public land, public water, places where people go to hunt, or they go to hike, or they go to fish, or bird watch, whatever it is, you know, so much of that activity takes place in publicly held land and water. But BHA, you know, got started, I want to say 15 years ago,
right.
you know, some roughly
15.
It
really 15. Just started to grow
it's grown exponentially the last 2-3 years.
That's right.
You know? And so originally, you think about public land, and we're here sitting in Northwest Arkansas. We're blessed to have national forest. I mean, we're basically sitting in the middle of it, but a lot of parts of the country don't have that. Of course, public land was a big deal out west. There's so many millions of acres of it out there. And when there started to become threats to that, to, you know, getting rid of that public land, I think that's when the movement really started to take hold and people started to pay attention to it. Now you think about it, there's public land exists for a lot of reasons, and recreation, it certainly is great for recreation. It's there for other uses as well, and BHA recognizes those uses. But the part of that BHA steps up for is the wildlife that's on it, and the people who use public right, lands yeah. and public waters for that purpose, to give them a voice at the table. Now, here in in the Southeast. You know, Arkansas right now is part of the Southeast chapter of BHA. We have six states now. Tennessee is just ready to break off and become their own state chapter.
Right.
So we'll be six states: Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and Florida.
Yeah.
And so we're kind of a regional chapter. It's a little bit of an experiment within BHA, but within each state, you know, we've got a leadership structure, and we focus on the issues that are particular to that area. So Arkansas, it might be the Buffalo River. It might be, you know, the Ozark National Forest. It might be something different in Louisiana. It's something different in every one of the states. But the great thing that we have, and I don't think most of the rest of the country understands this, we've all got that Southern camaraderie, you know, the Southeast Conference mentality, you know, it's us against everybody else. It just matters more here.
That's right.
So, but here in Arkansas, what we're specifically doing right now is building out leadership structure. We've recruited some just awesome guys that stepped up at first and said they want to be involved in helping. And we're not doing anything super formal with that right now, other than, you know, take advantage of their skills and their talents and desires. And then, you know, over the next, I don't know, let's say 6 or 8 months, we will start identifying we'll name the seats on the bus. We'll start putting people in those seats on the bus, and we're going to figure out where to drive the bus. That's the analogy that I like to use.
Yeah.
And we don't have any formal goals around, you know, being the next state to break out of the chapter, anything like that right now.
Yeah.
But what we do have is we want to get that leadership structure in place so that we can benefit from the rest of the Southeast chapter's leadership, and then bring BHA's message here to Arkansas. And what does that mean for Arkansas? That's another question we get all the time. Like, why do I need to join BHA? What's important in public lands and waters here in Arkansas? Think about, where does a lot of our duck hunting happen? Public land.
Yeah.
Public water. You know, we've got world-class trout fisheries, striper fisheries. We've got, you know, just all these different resources in the state that we've got that heritage of taking advantage of those here in Arkansas. And yeah, we're not maybe under direct threat right now. Let's hope we never get there. But let's part of an organization.
Let's have something in place for if it ever did happen.
Exactly right.
And I think you said it, but a lot of the Western issues revolve around public lands actually being sold back to the state. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty big deal. Like there's this keep, you know, public lands in public hands, and that's pretty much what that is referring back to. And in super layman's short terms, is that it doesn't sound so bad for public land to be sold back to the state, except the history of that transaction usually means that once it's sold to the state, they don't have enough money to maintain it, and they shut stuff down, and they potentially even ended up selling it into private hands.
Yep.
So it's like what BHA, from what I understand, and I'm a member of BHA, is that, you know, no net loss of public land anywhere in the country.
Right.
And an expansion of public lands, mm-hmm. and just the rights of who gets to go there. And, and a lot of those issues are more Western stuff, but there's plenty of stuff here in Arkansas that I'm sure that you guys will get involved with.
Yep. CWD is another one, just to briefly touch on. You know, that was something that was passed at Rendezvous just back in early May.
Yeah.
And we'll be advocating for more money for research and things like that. You know, obviously here in Arkansas, there's parts of our area that's a big deal.
Yeah. You know, I think the biggest thing that BHA has done on a national scale is brought attention to public lands.
Right.
And they've made it cool to appreciate public lands.
Mm-hmm.
And that is it's kind of a no-brainer, but I mean, I look at myself. I've been influenced by it. I mean, I've hunted public land my whole life, and it's kind of like it's just your right.
And that's where like a difference of how you and I grew up.
Yeah.
Cause in 20, I think it was 2016, we were on vacation. Maybe it's 2016. We're on vacation in Colorado, and we're driving through National Forest and BLM land, and I'm on my phone, like the kids are asking, what's public land mean, Dad? I'm like, man, I don't quite understand that. So, I mean, I'm Googling, what's the difference between BLM and Forest Service land? Yeah. And what is that? And we actually took, you know, much to my wife's chagrin, we just turned off the highway in one place and just took off, took the gate down, drove across, put the gate back up, and just drove out into this rolling pasture, you know, public land, and just went driving around, took pictures, you know, until it was my wife was like, okay, this is enough, let's go back to the road. And that's for me when it started to become real that like, okay, this is what it means, like this is a place we can go, just go do stuff. But I didn't have that experience growing up, so I had to physically experience it to get it.
Well, I think it's and I think just the knowledge of the history of public lands is so powerful too. And I mean, this is something that I would have known before, but it's like, it can't be denied that BHA has brought it to the forefront, in that this experiment with public lands in North America is a very unique thing to the world, very unique thing for the history of mankind, that a government would say this land is for everybody, because typically kings and monarchs took stuff for themselves. I mean, like, for real, like that's the king's forest. You can't go in there.
Right.
I mean, that's typically how the world has worked for a couple thousand years.
And that's what money does. Yeah. You know, money buys you exclusion in a lot of cases. And so it was a happy accident, I think, you know, to have that set aside.
I mean, it was just an experiment. I mean, it was Roosevelt and a bunch of other people that were just like, hey, these places are worth protecting. Let's make this eternally the land of, or, you know, the land owned by the people and citizens of the United States. And what we can't forget inside that narrative is that Roosevelt, not most of those guys that were influential inside of that, did it because they loved hunting.
Right.
I mean, for real.
You're absolutely right.
Now, obviously, the purpose of it was bigger than that, and Roosevelt knew that. I mean, like, this is, you know, not everybody's going to just come here to hunt, and there's some places that you couldn't hunt. I mean, the national parks and stuff. But in general, Roosevelt loved land because he loved to hunt. I'm reading a book by Roosevelt right now called Tales of the Grizzly, I think. He spelled grizzly with an S rather than a Z like we do today. And it was his book that he wrote about all his bear hunting. And I'm actually pretty amazed at the knowledge that he had, chapters and chapters on bear, just bear related, not biology really, but just his observations.
Okay.
And anyway, I mean, the guy was in love with wild places because of wildlife and because he loved to hunt. And
it's an interesting thing to think about, how people who love to go out and hunt that wildlife. I mean, yeah, I get it. Some people want to go look at it, but the ones spending the money on it and contributing to it are the hunters and anglers who are out there pursuing it for their recreational purpose.
Right.
And we can't beat that drum loud enough.
No. Where wildlife has cultural value, deep cultural value, specifically through hunting, it is protected. And where wildlife is protected, the only way to protect wildlife is through game regulations, but primarily through habitat preservation.
Yep.
I mean, we can't have bear and deer and turkeys and elk unless we got a place for them to live. So if you love wildlife, want to protect it, you protect habitat. And I mean, that is the drum. That's the drum.
Yep.
And going back to even jumping into what we're going to talk about, I mean, I think it's important that we understand the foundational ethics for why we're not just justified, but why it is right that we have the right to hunt.
Yeah.
You know, and the main thing too is that it's worked. It's no longer an experiment.
Right.
You know, 75 years ago it was kind of an experiment. You know, Roosevelt and them in 1889, I think 1887 maybe, was when they created the Boone and Crockett Club, and that was kind of the beginning point of coming from this century of mass degradation of wildlife, and then all these guys were like, "Wait a minute, all this big game's going to die off. We got to do something." So, I mean, that's kind of like a point when you could say something started. Then 40 or 50 years later, Aldo Leopold and a bunch of other guys started, you know, it just kind of built on it, and this idea of wildlife management, that we could manage this wildlife strategically and manage land. And it's like, back then it was kind of an experiment. Let's see if this works.
Yeah.
And then now here we are 120 years later, 130 years later, and the North American model of wildlife conservation and what we've done with habitat has created a continent that has more big game than any place on the earth.
Mm-hmm.
I tell people that on YouTube almost daily. I'm pointing my finger for all those of you listening. I'm pointing at Colby for emphasis. No, I'm serious, because on our YouTube channel, we get a lot of interaction from people from other countries.
Yeah.
They see us shoot a bear, and they it just makes them
irate. It's a visceral reaction, right?
Well,
for them, it is.
They think it's the last one on the earth.
Yeah.
For real. I mean, they're like, these are endangered. And it's always in broken English, you know?
Mm.
It's like, these are endangered. How could you do this? I hope your family dies.
Or
I'm serious.
Or symbols we try to get translations
for. Yeah, we have to do. Today, I translated a comment. I didn't know what it was. And it was actually a good comment. But, and I'm always, and I have this same banter that I always go back. It's just like, we have more big game than any place on the earth. Most places killed out their big game 1,000 years ago.
Or they put it, you know, it's held in reserve somewhere, you know, by the barons or, you know, the kings or whatever it is. And you can't go over there and do that.
Right.
Don't shoot the king's deer or whatever it is.
The king's stag.
Yeah.
Well, so, I mean, that's the thing that is so powerful to me, is that what we're doing is not an experiment. It's working, and it's the hunters that have primarily done it, and that's just hard to deny. And now that doesn't give us a right to just do whatever we want. I mean, it doesn't. But it is.
Well, and it's still, we still can't always agree on what that means as hunters, either.
And that's a good, maybe that's a good lead into even the conversation at hand.
Mm-hmm.
Just So bear hunting, if we're gonna open up that can, you know, hunting large predators in general is
a hot button topic.
It's a controversial topic amongst people that have no concept of hunting or rural lifestyle or tradition or scientific based wildlife management.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a hot button with them, but it's also a hot button with people, hunters,
right,
our allies that don't understand.
Yep.
So, and when we say large predators in North America, what we're talking about is grizzly bears, black bears, and mountain lions, basically.
Uh-huh.
Those would be the large predator. You can hunt polar bears in a few places, but those are the primary targets. That's what we're talking about.
Yep.
What would you say, or where would you like to start with? Just kind of some, and if you wanted even to just pick a certain method of hunting.
Yeah. Well, let's, because I brought it up before, so let's talk about baiting a little bit.
And I knew you were going to bring it up.
Yeah. You were ready.
You just baited yourself into that one.
Oh, pun.
Wow.
Always good at puns.
So you've walked into my trap.
Exactly.
Yeah. So
ensnared. Another form.
Colby, you gotta jump in here too.
I'm gonna
help me.
I'm gonna dial him back now.
You gonna dial him back?
Yeah.
All right.
So when it comes to baiting, obviously some places in the US you can and some places you can't.
Yeah.
So as I came, so first of all, you know, my first introduction to big game hunting was obviously whitetail, as it is for most people. And that's about all I did. And that's about all I wanted to do. And then started to get a little bit more interested in maybe a Western hunt. I went on a pronghorn hunt last fall.
Mm.
And that was fun. You know, I would say that equating it to something in the fishing world, that's like taking your kid out and going bluegill fishing. You know,
okay,
putting some worms and going to the dock. And I mean, it's not quite that easy. It's a little more difficult than that, but lots of things to see, lots of game. You get to see it moving around all over the place. Okay. So I've crossed that bridge. I'm like, okay, now stuff's getting a little more interesting to me. But like when it comes to hunting bears, why would you use bait?
Right.
Why? And I even only just took up archery hunting last fall and never wasn't successful at all. Didn't really get a shot at anything. But why would you need bait to hunt a bear?
Well, can I ask you a question first?
We'll see.
Let me put it back. No, like, would you, like, from a new hunter coming into this, would you have ethical issues? Like, if you were to go do it?
Yeah. So, I think that's a good question
What would be the thing that would be like, this could be bad?
See, I feel a little uneasy about it from the standpoint of altering the
natural habit of the bear.
The natural habit of the bear, exactly.
And taking advantage of it.
And that's, I think that's just something that's formed in me over time. It's not necessarily, you know, I'm not repeating, I mean, I've heard that said before, but
right.
I think from the standpoint of, if I wanted to try to be in as natural of environment as I could, then the use of bait to me feels like I'm altering that in a way that's unfair to the animal.
The bear. Okay. No, that's good. You know, I think the baseline understanding that a lot of people don't have about bear is that bears are so widely geographically distributed. I say this all the time, from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean, from the northern boreal forest all the way down to old Mexico, mm-hmm. is the native black bear range.
Okay.
And we're talking about black bears. Okay. We're talking about baiting. Let's just say that. And
now, why is that? Why is it only black bears when you're talking about that? Just because we know hungry grizzlies everywhere?
Baiting grizzlies would be like a pretty rare thing.
Okay.
It's legal in Alaska and a few places. So it's just not that. I just feel like it's more relevant to talk about baiting black bears.
Why isn't it legal, though?
Because they don't have any trouble. Well, that's a great question. Because they don't have any trouble managing the populations with other methods.
Okay, gotcha. That's a great thing to say.
So that is ultimately... So if you understand this wide geographic distribution of black bear in these wide varieties of habitats... Eastern deciduous forest, basically from where we're at right now in western Arkansas all the way to the Atlantic Ocean, for the most part, today is heavily forested.
Yep.
Eastern deciduous forest. Most places in Arkansas, the visibility is about 50 yards.
Yeah.
So what I'm getting at, and I can describe it in more detail, is that the only places that you can bait bears, it is used as a management tool to harvest the amount of bears that they need harvested out of a certain region.
So it's more of a scientific approach rather than a convenience approach.
1,000%. I mean, that's not even like doctored up theory. That is the truth.
No, you didn't have to go to your like bear hunter manual and this is what you say. That's what the biologist would say.
Exactly. No, I'm being serious. I mean, sometimes we spin things.
Yeah,
and when I say I'm just talking like mankind in general can spin something to make it feel like it's in his favor. But I mean, a lot of Western states, if they can harvest, because what states do, state biologists, the ethic of wildlife management organizations run by the federal government or the state government is that we want to utilize wildlife for the people, but also for the greatest good of that particular species of animal.
Right.
In general. I mean, that's the ethic of it. And so wildlife managers say we have this amount of habitat, we have this number of animals, this amount of habitat will hold this number of animals. That population of animals expands by this mathematical percentage every year. And for bear, that's 10% per year. So if you have a population of 1,000 animals, next year you're going to have 1,100 animals. The next year, you're going to have
1,211.
Yeah. So what they say is to stabilize so once that population fills up the habitat, then they have to take out the surplus animals every year. And so they find ways to do that through management tools, which would either be through spot and stalk hunting, where there's no... can't bait, can't run hounds. All you can do is just go out in the woods and try to kill a bear. They did that in Arkansas for 21 years.
Okay.
From 1980 to 2001. And we killed about 5 to maybe the maximum amount of bears we ever killed was 50 in the entire state in a given year. Well, the population began to expand so much that the Game and Fish said, we have to have a way to manage these bears through hunters. And so they said, we're going to open up baiting bears on public land, and we're going to manage these bears through Arkansas's bow hunters. So baiting was the only way that it could be done.
Private land.
Private land in Arkansas.
Yeah.
Private land in certain zones in Arkansas. And so baiting is a management tool. And that was the foundational point, James, that I was going to say that has to be understood, is that we take these things and we turn them into, and I'm going to air quotes, sport. I mean, because we enjoy hunting.
Yeah,
we do.
Right. And if we didn't enjoy it, we wouldn't do it.
No. And so what somebody might see is sport, but actually we're killing two birds with one beautiful stone. Mm-hmm. And that beautiful stone is that we're managing wildlife based upon science, based upon things that have worked in the past and are working extremely well. But we're also enjoying the resource. We're enjoying hunting. We're enjoying bear meat. We're enjoying the challenge. We're enjoying these things. Mm-hmm. And so so that would be like the foundational thing. This is a management tool. Let me go on. Shall I go on? Yes.
Please do.
The management tools, the more effective a management tool is, the more selective that hunters can be. So like in baiting, I can be highly selective on which animal I take out. And the hunting culture of a certain region dictates kind of how that plays out. What we're trying to do in Arkansas is to build, and this is going to throw people off. But I won't use the catchphrase that'll throw people off. We're trying to tell people shoot older mature males over bait.
Yeah.
That's the target animal.
The T word.
Don't say it.
Trophy hunting.
No, for real.
But there's a reason for that. There's a biological reason for that, right?
Absolutely. I mean, to an older mature male has already contributed to the gene pool, and there is no net loss on the population when he is extracted. So by targeting older mature males, we give preference to juveniles and females and let them grow up and do what they do. So, I mean, like, hunting older mature males is the best thing to do in almost any type of population. Mm-hmm. And so when I say the most effective, like, we could go out here on private land in good bear country in Arkansas and get 7 or 8, 10 bears coming into our bait. Now, could you go in there with a bow and kill one on any given day? Man, you've got your work cut out for you. And a lot of people wouldn't understand that.
Yeah.
And that isn't necessarily what this conversation is about. But you can be selective.
Okay.
When I go into the national forest to hunt bears, let me just stop right there and say, are those points clear?
Yeah.
Highly selective.
Yep.
And it's a management tool.
I think the management tool piece of it is, that's like a driver. Like a lightning strike kind of thing. When we talk about hunting as conservation, and most hunters will use that as a justification, hunting as conservation. Okay, so if we're going to use hunting as conservation, then we need to be effective with it. And so in bear hunting, you know, even though I don't do that right now, and I don't understand it, if that's the best way to manage that population for conservation, then that's a gateway. Like I can step over that chasm that I had. Now I have a bridge to get from one side to the other, and I can say, okay, I can respect that. I can understand that. Now, I could say maybe baiting isn't the right way to go about other species, and we don't have to get into that. But for bears, okay, I get it.
And that's a good point. Probably for white-tailed deer, we could kill all the white-tailed deer we needed without baiting in Arkansas.
Probably.
Yeah. I mean, like, but
we might have to sharpen our skills a little bit.
We'd have to get,
But but I know what you're saying. I'm picking up what you're putting
down. Okay, I think the term would be the counterfactual is, what if there was no baiting? Let's look at that world. Let's look at the world of Arkansas where, you know, people just said, you can't bait bears. That's wrong. Well, this is what would happen is that, and I know this because I have tracked Arkansas bear hunting for the last 20 years. And I mean, there are very few people in the state of Arkansas that are consistently going out and killing bears in the national forest. Just without bait, without hounds, without,
right.
Just like going out and just hunting them like deer. Very few people. Now, granted, if that was the only thing we could do, there would be more people doing it, and people would find ways to be successful.
Well, maybe, but you'd also lose some people.
Yes.
Because you can only go out and beat your head against a rock for so long before you give up.
Yes, that's a good point. So here's what would happen. I mean, I can guarantee you this is what would happen, is we would maybe get to a point where we killed 150 bears a year. And we have got to take out 400 bears a year for this bear population not to just explode.
Well, and so I think that's a good segue into something else I wanted to ask you about, which is what happens when the bear population explodes?
Good question.
So bear hunting as it's a management tool. Obviously, you've got, if you get too many bears, you get too many of any animal on the landscape, you know, that causes problems with what they eat and the habitat. They destroy the habitat. But what else goes on?
Well, there's a phrase that biologists use called cultural tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the cultural tolerance of this region for people to have bears walking through their yard?
And people
that
have
bears walking up on their porch eating their bird feeders. Stuff like this. But here's a version of what would happen is that bears would begin to saturate into places that people don't want them. There would be bears, you know, I live kind of in the city limits of a rural town in northwest Arkansas. I mean, if there were bears walking through this town every day, rummaging through people's, we'd have all kind of problems that would put pressure on the game and fish. Game and fish would have to trap 400 to 500 problem bears a year. Massive amount of money, massive amount of energy.
Uh-huh.
They'd have problem bears, and ultimately, bears would die.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately,
they're going to die one way or the other.
Ultimately, they would euthanize the amount of bears that they would have to.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it'd be a good experiment to just let this thing go for 50 years and see how many bears they had to euthanize in order to stabilize the population.
It's kind of happened with grizzlies now in the Yellowstone.
Exactly.
That's what I was thinking.
We did a podcast with Joe Condellis, Yellowstone Bear Country Association.
Western Bear Foundation
now.
Formerly known as.
Yeah. The state officials killed 44 grizzly bears last year. Euthanized 44 problem grizzly bears that they had. And you know out there, they don't want to kill those things.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Like this is like last resort. They euthanized 44 bears. What we're fighting for out there is a 20 bear hunter quota for bears. All we're saying is, let us have 20 bear tags a year that we can utilize. And they're killing more. They're killing more inside of that.
What happens when you start to hunt a predator like that?
Man, that we talked a little bit about this on the podcast that just came out, but when you have an unhunted population of top predators, apex predators, they just get bold and it changes them.
Mm-hmm.
They get bold and it changes them and they become dangerous. The most dangerous grizzly bears on the planet are out there in the Yellowstone region.
Okay.
I've thought, well, what good is it going to do to kill 20 bears out in these places? Because you're not going to hunt them like in the city limits of Cody, Wyoming, where they're actually causing problems. Okay, do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
We'd be hunting these bears in the national forest out in the wilderness.
But if they're out there, if you hunt them out there and leave enough space out there for them to live, they don't have to go to town.
Joe described it that it's like a bucket. You know, there's only so much volume in that bucket for bears. The bucket is full, and now water is flowing over the top.
Right.
And so these grizzly bears are in a bunch of places they were never even naturally before.
Yeah.
I mean, like, that's the way I understood Jim Sessions and Joe to say it.
Yeah.
Is that there are grizzly bears now today in that region inhabiting places that historically grizzlies didn't even live. Like, plain, you know, like, And it's because there's this bucket that's a really good bucket that's full spilling out. So if you harvested some of those bears out of the main bucket, they wouldn't be having to flow out.
But isn't part of the argument in the courts around grizzly bears this argument about connecting populations together, and you would have to have a certain number of, I mean, you would have to overflow that bucket to force those populations to go together. So it seems like there's this, I mean, it's not counterintuitive, but it's like the two ideas clash with each other. Like we must have these bears connect with the other populations, but when they overflow the bucket, it's, you know, water takes the easiest course downhill. And so that's Cody, Wyoming, let's say, or wherever it is that they
I think some of those arguments are probably just a good way for them to stall this thing inside of court. I mean, would it be ideal for these, like the Selway bitterroot population of grizzlies and this other, and I'm not an expert really on the geography there, but I mean, would it be ideal that all these populations interbred and there are bears moving back and forth? I'm sure it would be. But is it essential? No. I mean, that's from what I have filtered, but it is a, I mean, the anti-hunting groups are just concerned about keeping this in court for eternity. They would keep it in court for the next 70 years. It's good business for them.
Yeah,
it's,
they make money off of it.
They make money off it. I mean, like, but to get back to our Arkansas analogy, I mean, that's essentially what would happen here.
We would deal with those same kind of bear issues. For example, if I'm vacation out in Colorado, you know, when you roll into town, they're trying to educate every tourist, do not feed the bears.
Yeah.
We do not want the bears coming into town. Everybody's like, oh, I want to see a bear. Well, that's, we don't want to see bears in town.
Yeah.
And we would deal with that same kind of thing in Arkansas, right?
Yeah. And you know, here is something that a lot of hunters wouldn't know and actually kind of goes against in some ways our message, is that a hunted population of bears grows and expands faster than an unhunted population.
Why is that?
Think about that. It's just a bear fact.
Is it because they tend to stay in the areas? They'll get more remote.
It's even more mysterious than that. And I've never heard anybody give a real good explanation of it, but basically it's an increase in litter size. I mean, think about it, like a sow bear out in the mountains here in Arkansas, somehow her body perceives that animals are being extracted from the population. And so she rears three cubs rather than two. I mean, that is essentially the way it works. Okay. That's what's happening in Oklahoma. Like, we opened up the season in Oklahoma 10 years ago, I think. And so they're currently inside of a research project where they're trying to understand the impact of harvesting 40 or 50 bears out of a population. Because that's all they kill in Oklahoma, between 40 and 70 bears a year.
Okay.
And what they're seeing is increase in litter size already.
Huh.
And so, but... So again, like as a hunter that's wanting to hunt, you know, we say, well, we're going to control the population through hunting. It's true, but you actually have to begin. It creates a beautiful, wonderful cycle because
it creates more bears
to hunt. But it also, like, if you were just a staunch anti-hunter and you said, we want bears on the landscape, I want bears crawling in my windows at night, then we'd say, good, let us hunt them. I mean,
yeah,
because
we'll have more of them that way. Quicker.
That's right.
We'll
that's
have
what
more
I'm saying. Okay, you think about it this way too. Arkansas's had basically the floodgates of Arkansas bear hunting opened in 2001 when we were allowed to hunt bear over bait. For 21 years, from 1980 to 2001, all it was just spot and stalk bear hunting in Arkansas, and we killed between 5 and, I can't remember.
50,
even,
I think you said.
Yeah, I mean, and honestly, I don't even know if we ever killed 50.
Okay.
2001, we started killing bears. We started killing between 200 and 500 bears a year. Let's just say 20 years, we killed 300 bears a year. Math for me. How many bears is that?
6,000 bears.
We've killed 6,000 bears in the last 20 years in Arkansas. And we have more bears today than we've ever had.
And more people. I mean, honestly, more people than we've ever had. Yeah. So go figure.
You talked to Myron Means, the bear biologist for the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission, to verify that statement I just said. I promise you, I could text him right now. Do we have more bears in Arkansas than we've had in the last 100 years? And he would say, yes.
Someday, I would love to see an Arkansas bear in the wild. Never seen one.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people haven't.
Yeah.
You know, they
it's
pop
a neat
up,
experience.
What, swimming across Beaver Lake the other day? Did you see that?
I did. Yeah. Well, there was a bear in this town a few weeks ago, like right over here, which is pretty. I mean, there's bear habitat here close. There's I've seen bear sign in this hollow across the road from me.
Okay.
But I mean, I've never seen a bear on my property. But it's my dream to one day see a bear on the property, just walking right through the backyard.
You should start putting some food out for him.
He's the one who doesn't like bait.
He's converted.
It didn't take much.
Yeah. Man, I'm weak. You converted me right away.
No, that's a lot of people don't understand baiting. Like, they have this, is it fair? And that's really not the right question. Because if the macro concern is the health of wildlife and how they live inside of habitat, then we have to go back to what's the best management tool for this resource. Mm-hmm. And then once you actually start baiting bears, you realize how hard it is.
Yeah.
Which is true.
And I've heard you mention that before.
I mean, success rate in Arkansas for bears, they don't really have a statistic, but I bet it would be like 20-30%.
It's hard to get a statistic because we all get a bear tag, right?
That's exactly right.
So,
And then they also leave the bait to go to natural foods really quick.
And that's the thing that makes it tough here, is that they leave bait to go to natural foods. So a bear would rather eat a white oak acorn as he would a donut or anything you could put out for him.
Most animals are like that. It's kind of odd how they figure that out. It's better to eat the natural stuff than whatever it is we put out for them.
Yeah. We're the only species that hadn't figured that out.
Well,
we'd rather eat Cheetos.
I'd rather eat venison.
Meat. Yes. Yeah, good. That was good. That got us right back on track.
Yes. Agreed. Man, let's talk about that.
Well, okay. There's another point that I think is a massive stumbling block for people, is that they say, are you going to eat it?
Yeah.
Do you eat bear?
Well, I want to come at it from a little bit different angle, if that's okay with
for
you.
Sure.
So one of the things that I think has always been a roadblock, well, I use always loosely, a roadblock for me, I heard somebody say once that when you get down and you start skinning out a bear, man, it really looks like a person when you get all the fur off of it. Is that true?
I mean, it looks more like a person than a skinned deer looks like a person.
Yeah.
I mean, so I can see somebody saying that.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, that's just something you have to get over then.
I mean, yeah.
I guess I'd liken that to the first few times I killed a deer. I struggled with gutting it.
Okay.
And doing all that. And now it's just like...
He's honest.
You know, last year was the first year. Because at my in-law's place, it was like, bring the four-wheeler. We got one down. We take it back up to the house, string it up, do all the stuff. Last year was the first year that I was like, I'm going to do this right there. I killed it right there. I'm going to just do it right here in the field. It was way easier to do it that way than stringing it up and having the, you know, guts flopping out of it and blood running down on my shoes and everything. I mean, yes, okay, you get into it a little bit more in your elbows and stuff, but you get over it. And if you want it bad enough, you get past it.
Being desensitized to a really natural and normal process.
Taking it all the way from the field to your table helps a lot with that.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I just realized what I should have said when you said, does a bear look like a human when it's skinned?
Okay, what?
I should have said, I never skinned a human. Have you?
No.
Okay, that's what I should have said.
Yeah, I get to stay for a little while longer.
Oh, man, we're just pounding away here. We're on time. No, so, well, let's stay on this just a minute. Like, a lot of people don't understand that a bear's diet... A lot of people would say, well, eating a bear is like eating a coyote.
Yeah.
You know, they would think like, you know, the kind of the old mosaic law of like, don't eat anything without a cloven hoof? I mean, like cow, sheep, deer.
Don't eat a pig.
Yeah. I mean, like, And so, you know, certainly something that doesn't have hooves you wouldn't eat,
mm-hmm.
you know. But a bear pretty much has a diet not much different than a wild turkey when you actually realize.
Just a lot more.
Well, this is that analogy only works in this scenario. 85% of a bear's diet is plant matter.
Okay.
15% is protein from animal protein. Of that 15%, like 85% of that, typically for Arkansas bears anyway, is insects.
No kidding.
Yeah. I mean, they're grubbing fools.
Okay.
Ants. I mean, they roll logs and eat ants. I mean, that's essentially like what a turkey eats. I mean, but will they catch a fawn if they see one? Heck yeah.
But that's only going to be for a few weeks.
Absolutely. And now you get into bears that are influenced by salmon streams and stuff, and you're in a totally different category.
Right.
There's going to be periods of time that they're going to be eating a lot of fish-based protein.
And you don't want to eat those bears, right?
Well, I just can't say that I have ever eaten a black bear that was like just pounding salmon. I've heard people say it's not bad. I've heard people say it's terrible. It's just all over the board.
Well, end of the day, you're not going to kill it and not try to do something productive with it.
Right.
You know, you're going to try it one way or the other. It may not be, you know, just like you go to the store and buy beef. I mean, sometimes you get a steak that's really good and sometimes it's not really good. So I guess you just kind of have to take what you get.
Yeah.
But it's good. Well, you're working around to say it's good.
It's good. I mean, like, I could feed you bear in my house and you would think it was beef. I mean, I just really believe that. Like, if you had no idea who I was and you were just sent to my house to eat dinner and you walked to my house, I could feed you something and you'd just be like, that's good. It's good meat. I mean, it's good.
Had an interesting rub on it, a little sweetness to it.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe so.
Maybe.
So...
Colby's got a product he's working on.
Yeah. Yeah. No, so it's good. Magazine. And historically, you know, I think a lot of I don't know if there's really a place for this, but, you know, in today's society, everybody's so interested in preserving traditions and traditions of their people. Man, our people ate bear on this continent for a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, and I guess when I say our people, I mean people who moved here. Even though
settlers.
Maybe a lot of us have some Native American probably somewhere way back there, but that's what I'm talking about. And I mean, you know, there's historical literature here in Arkansas that said if you know, in the early 1800s, sat down at a dinner table in the Ozark Mountains of Arkansas and had red meat, there's about an 80% chance it was black bear. You know, I mean, there's a lot of historical usage. And here's what happened in Arkansas is that for 75 years, we didn't hardly have bears because they were extirpated by habitat loss and market hunting, which is very different from what we do today.
Yep.
There's a big misunderstanding there with just the general public as they think, well, hunters are the ones that killed all the wildlife at the turn of the century. Man, they were basically like farmers. I mean, they were going out to reap a harvest to market it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just nothing like what we do.
Right.
You know, we kill one bear a year and they're happy. Market hunter might kill, you know, Daniel Boone killed 155 bears in one winter. You know, I mean, so it's like very different. But so it's historical usage. It's a good meat. And, you know, you do have to cook it thoroughly. It can carry trichinella, but that's just a non-issue. Trichinella dies, I believe, at just over 145 degrees or something, which is, we don't cook hardly anything that other than like a rare steak.
Yep.
You just want to cook it and you'll be totally fine.
They say, does it die if you freeze it for a certain amount of time too?
I've heard there's different strains of it, and some strains die in when it's frozen, some strains don't. So it's always
better
good
just cook it.
Just cook it.
Just good. Cook it till just it's dead.
Good. And then you have the fat.
Yeah. So tell me, like, what all do you do with the fat? This is intriguing to me because obviously whitetail, it's like, oh, get rid of the fat.
Yeah.
You know, and I know there's some people that are kind of trying to break that stigma now, but tell me about bear fat.
Well, I've actually got about 30 pounds of bear fat thawing out in my freezer or my refrigerator as we speak, because we're going to render some bear fat this week. And I've got three different types of bear fat. I've got some bear fat from Manitoba, Canada, from Montana, and from Oklahoma. And all these bears were eating different things in different parts of the country. We're going to render them down, and we're going to try a couple different methods for rendering them. But basically, bear fat is it's just like pig lard, a white lard, and you cook it down, and it turns into oil. And there's all kinds of traditional uses, and not even I say traditional, and just in that it, that used to be the only thing that people had.
Yeah.
But Colby ordered a oil burning lamp for the office here that we're gonna use bear oil in that lamp. It burns a smokeless flame. So we'll have this glass, and that's what people use it for. I mean, think about being a pioneer here in the Ozarks in the early 1800s. Nobody had ever dreamed of electricity.
Yeah.
And, man, it gets dark at 6 o'clock in the wintertime, and, you know, candles only burn for so long, but you killed a bear last fall, and you rendered, 3 gallons of bear oil. Man, that stuff burns. I mean, so you can use it for burning oil lamps, but you use it for cooking. I mean, well, that squirrel video we did, that was at the BHA deal.
Yep.
We cooked that squirrel meat in just straight bear fat, and it does not have a wild taste. I mean, you would just think like bear fat would just be like this, like it's just oil. It doesn't even have a flavor.
Hmm.
It's just lard. So you cook with it. What bear fat is renowned for is for baking. Any baking product that you would use oil, like for pie crust primarily.
Thinking about that. I made that turkey that I shot this spring. I made turkey schnitzel last night, and then I have a family recipe that goes way back. My family's originally from Germany. There's some recipe that was handed down. Mm. We call it Mayröschen. It's basically just like an apple pastry.
Oh.
So I made homemade dough and made Mayröschen, you know, with just some, I had to cut some Crisco into
it.
I'm going to
give you some bear oil when we get it rendered down.
Oh, that's like a parting gift for being on the show. That's great.
we've got to render it down first, but for real, I'll give you some, even if it's just as a keepsake.
Yeah.
The other, it's people used it for oil and knives and guns and stuff.
Okay.
For leather conditioner. I mean, pretty much anything. There's only so many things you can do with oil, animal fat.
Mm-hmm.
And anything you can do with anything else, you can do with bear fat.
Yep. Oh, that's cool.
Except there's one thing you can do with bear fat that you can't do with anything else, and that is forecast the weather.
No kidding.
I was actually just reading an article. No, there is like legitimate. There was a guy named George Wimsatt. Okay.
Okay.
Back in New Mexico, he died in like 95 or something, and you read about him. Phenomenal guy that was covered on all these different news stations, and he spent 60 years. There was Native American like folklore that you could forecast the weather. Looking at bear oil, they used to put bear oil in deer gallbladder or bladders.
Okay.
They would preserve the oil by putting it in a bladder. And when it dried, it was clear and you could see through the oil. And so they would store this bear oil in these bladders, and the oil would change and it would bubble and it would change colors, which it does. Bear oil does that. It changes
just
colors.
Just based on atmospheric pressure and
temperature, atmospheric pressure. And so this guy began to study it and kept detailed records for 60 years and was like predicting weather with like great certainty.
Well, we got some folks who probably, learn a thing or two from that then.
Yeah.
We need to get them out in the woods and get a bear for some of these meteorologists.
Yep.
And then maybe they could correlate and we could improve
the
accuracy.
There's actually a story where in his hometown, that the local meteorologist and him kind of for like a publicity stunt did a deal where they both forecasted and saw who was right. and George was right that week. Like he won. It was like a contest. Yeah. I read this today. That's from back awesome. Back in
now,
the
what
80s.
Was it? What was his cat's name?
I believe it was George Wimsatt.
Wimsatt. Okay.
Wimsatt.
Maybe we can put it in the show notes.
There we go.
Yeah.
On the website.
So I've had bear fat on the south facing windowsill for many years. And I plan to we actually talked about it today.
Learn.
We're gonna
learn how to forecast the weather.
We're gonna do some experiments. No, I've got bear fat right there. Actually,
okay.
You see that jar right there?
Yep.
That is about 6 year old.
Oh. Jetta.
That is about 6 year old bear fat. So that is not good. Bear fat. Bear fat will stay good in a windowsill like that for about 2 years at room temperature.
Wow.
But that's just been there for years. I rendered it. But hey, let's talk about one more thing. We've pretty much run our gamut here, but did you want to talk about hounds?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sorry, I had to wet my whistle there. Yeah. So obviously, that's another. As I get all kinds of love here from
a bear dog.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, I'm serious. This dog right here. He himself is not a bear dog, but his entire genealogy on both sides goes back to bear and mountain lion hounds. That's ironic. That right when I do it, Jed just like totally cuddled up right to James and just like leaning on him and slobbering on him.
He's trying to convert me.
Yeah.
So that's the other thing I think that, you know, again, going back to my
Jed.
To my
Jed's crawling his lap now.
To my background is, okay, you know, if you see dogs running deer, you shoot those dogs.
Yeah.
Right? That's what I was told. Now, we didn't have a big problem with that, but the mindset that it placed in me was, okay, dogs chasing game equals bad.
Right.
So, and I've understood now there's other perspectives on that, but briefly, why would you need to use dogs for that? Like, what's the benefit of that? Is it just the same kind of thing as it is with bait?
Right. Well, to go back to the very foundational place, it's a management tool.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, we could have in Arkansas, they could have said, we're going to let hound hunters manage the bear population. And we could have killed as many bears as we wanted. I mean, like, or, you know, you could have taken out the percentage you needed. Let me say that.
Right.
So the places that have hound hunts in the States and in Canada, they hunt hounds in lots of the Canadian provinces. It is a management tool just like baiting. So I'll say that to say it's a scientific based management tool to help game agencies gain their objectives for harvesting bears. Number one. Number two, what a lot of people would say is that, you know, well, isn't this kind of, you know, I've heard people say it's barbaric or it's old, so old fashioned. Like, aren't we beyond using dogs to like harass game?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all the worst of what you could ever imagine
right.
has been said about this. And this goes back some to tradition, but also to, those are the worst possible stories. We've been running hounds, especially in the eastern United States, since Europeans got here.
Uh-huh.
And then Native Americans started running hounds too. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite books that we're going to talk about in another podcast, right here in the Ozarks, there's this whole story about Native Americans having bear hounds, and they ran bears out here at White Rock.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's like, it's not just the white Europeans that were the ones running hounds.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, they say George Washington brought over hounds from Europe. So it's an effective tool to manage game. You can catch a lot of game. But I go back to that effectiveness for selecting certain species. Hound hunting is the only catch and release type of hunting.
True. That's a fair point.
That's what we say is that you tree an animal, and then you decide, you got all the time in the world to decide if that's an animal that you want to take.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
it's so you can decide if it's a mature male or it's a sow or whatever.
Exactly. Let me go ahead and say this while I'm thinking about it. There's a lot of people would think that spot and stalk would be like the purest, most ethical form of hunting, which I love spot and stalk hunting, like out west. We just got back from Montana.
Yep.
It's probably the least selective way to,
because you see it from so far away, you have very difficult to tell what it is.
And you might hunt for a week and see one animal. I mean, Clay Newcomb is a perfect case in point. I was going to shoot that blonde bear. You saw the video. Did you see some of the Montana video?
Yeah.
Well, mate, I can't remember if you did. I thought you
I can't remember
you
if I saw that
Maybe you just saw the teaser.
I think I saw the teaser.
Okay, well, there was a blonde bear in the teaser. I didn't mean to put you on the spot. You better start watching our stuff.
He just saw me falling off the mule. Well, I saw that a couple times.
Okay, well, maybe that's what you saw. No, he just said he saw something about mine. That video just came out. Don't feel bad. No, there was a blonde bear that I didn't really have time to judge.
Yeah.
And I was going to shoot the bear and actually the one that missed.
Yes, okay, I did see
and,
that.
And boy, after I shot, I was like, man, that was a small sow.
And you were thankful that you missed at that
point. I was. I mean, and now if I'd killed it, I would have just been like, you know, I would have been happy. I mean, like, this is spot and stalk hunting. You know, you just take what you can get.
Yeah.
And that's true. But so, like, that narrative that spot and stalk hunting is the, that's the pure way. That's the ethical way. That's the sportsman's way.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying you can't be selective in spot and stalk hunting. I mean, somebody could easily combat that and say, well, you got... But it's you more see difficult my point. To be... You see my point. You go on a hound hunt, you could look at, I don't know, 3 or 4 bears in a week. I mean, they're hard to treat. That's the other thing. It's extremely difficult. It takes an extremely dedicated person and houndsman to be good. 1 in 20 bear hounds ends up being a real bear hound. Mm-hmm. I mean, like these dogs, like, you know, I mean, like there's a, these guys devote their lifetimes to breeding these dogs. And it's very difficult to tree animals. And,
they're not so, house dogs.
But you see my point is that it's another way to be selective.
Okay.
And here's the thing, and I'll put this on the table, is that people say that it's inhumane. Like, because absolutely, there are bears that get caught on the ground. I mean, we got to say that. There are bay-ups on the ground. When a dog is looking at the face of a bear, and I mean, it's like, you know, they're being bayed up. From an I think that, in general, most people don't understand the ferociousness of the natural world. That bear has been in so many bear fights. That bear, I mean, for him to swat at those dogs for, and I'm just being honest, this is just the truth, for that bear to swat at those dogs and be run around for however long is a small, is an easy thing for him to overcome.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like
his life has spent preparing for that thing, right?
He's got claws and teeth.
Yeah.
And here's another thing. We have hyper-emotionalized death so much as a culture.
Yeah.
If a bear or a squirrel or a turkey is not killed by a God-fearing, ethical hunter, then he will die a very terrible death.
Mm-hmm.
Guaranteed.
Yeah.
I mean, you see a bear walk through my yard out here and you go, what a beautiful animal. How would you ever want to kill that thing? Okay. Well, what's the counterfactual? I don't send my kids out that have a tag to go kill it. And let's say it's in season. They kill that bear. Well, let's say they don't kill it. I say, boys, don't do it. It's a beautiful animal. Let's let it live. What are the possibilities for that animal's death? If we're talking about being humane,
yep.
Like if the whole point of a human is just to be this pristine spiritual creature that causes nothing harm.
And just dictates humaneness on every single creature.
Really? Tell me what could happen to that bear.
Hit by a car.
Hit by a car.
Mauled by another bear.
Mauled or killed by another bear.
Yeah.
Die of disease, die of old age, die starvation. Of mange, die of starvation. I mean, like, contrast that with being shot with an arrow and living for 8 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Contrast that with being chased by dogs for an hour and a half, being treed, sitting in a tree, and then getting killed. The resource of the animal, the meat, hide, fur, fat, being utilized in a productive way,
mm-hmm.
built towards a scientific goal that's going to help all the other animals thrive because of that bear's absence.
Yep.
You with me?
Yep.
I mean, so it's like people have hyper-emotionalized death. That pretty animal that you see out there in Yellowstone is going to die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, someday. Yep. Someday.
I mean, so that and you know, going back to the dog thing, animal conflict is very natural.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and in most cases, bears run up trees and mm-hmm. the bears and dogs never fight.
Yep.
And it's a highly selective tool. And what most people don't understand if they say it's not fair chase, I promise you Anybody that says that bear hunting with hounds is not fair chase has never done it.
I mean, there's a lot of chase involved in it, right?
Yes.
A lot of effort.
Some of the toughest people that I know are hound hunters, just in terms mm-hmm. of like woodsmen, mm-hmm. just like woodsmen tough. And you would think that, I mean, people think that hunting over bait and hounds is just like the lazy fat man sport, you know. But some of the toughest guys and most, and they're not mountain fit like Instagram boys. they're tough.
Yeah,
and they're hunters and they holy cow! I could tell you some stories of being in West Virginia, and the first time I hunted in West Virginia, the dogs treed a bear way off this mountain, and I was with these guys that were older than me. Way older than me. They didn't exactly look like CrossFit athletes, and they were like, "All right, let's go to that bear." And I looked at them and I said, "You mean we're just like going straight to those dogs?" And they looked at me like I was crazy.
Like, what else would we do?
They're like, yeah, that's pretty much the only way to get there. And I was like, "All right." And I mean, we went through a holler that, I mean, just it blew my mind for real. I was like, "Wow." I mean, because the hunting we do here in Arkansas, I mean, that I even do in the backcountry, I wouldn't have done anything like that.
Wow.
I mean, it was just like crazy. They just do it. It took them a long time. I mean, mm-hmm. it's not like they were fast.
Yeah.
But so there's a little bit of a hound spiel. Yeah. Do you have any other, honest questions about that or thoughts on that?
No, I mean, I think from the standpoint of understanding the various methods of take as a method of management or means of management, and how do we deal with the population in a way that balances many competing demands, I think that's very helpful. And I think even from a standpoint, you know, we have our different camps within the hunting community, but then obviously there's many more people in the camp that's outside the hunting community.
Right.
And I feel like one of the best ways that we as hunters can move the conversation forward is to know these things. Even if you don't, you know, if I never hunt a bear in my life.
You don't have to hunt over hounds.
You know.
You don't have to hunt over bait.
Yeah. But I need to understand why that is. Why do other people do it that way and not take shots at other people because they choose to do something that way, assuming that the reason that they do that is because there's a benefit to it, to the population of the animal.
Right.
Like you said, we don't just get out there and run them with hounds so we can, you know, laugh and have fun. We do it to be selective.
Right.
So I think understanding those things, I think unfortunately, and a lot of hunters don't want to hear this message, but we have to do better.
Yeah.
We have to understand more about what it is we're trying to do. Yes. We have to be able to be advocates for what we want to do, because our ability to do it depends 100% on the majority of people who don't.
That's right.
And they'll take it away from us. You've said that, and you just have to look in the parts of the country where it is happening, in whatever the right. small ways that it happens. People who don't understand it, you know, they're inconvenienced by X, Y, or Z, you know, or they don't agree with, you know, they think it's lazy hunting over bait, whatever it is. It's our job to come together as sportsmen and sportswomen and speak facts to remove that emotional component from it.
Right.
And just try to first do no harm, you know, number one thing, first do no harm. Let's don't ruin it for the rest of us. But then if you can advocate and even just move the needle a little bit on somebody who's neutral, that's a win
right.
for us.
I think a lot of the hunting community would like to say, hey, let's just give them hounds and bait.
For real. Yeah, just give it away. Just let them have that and then we'll still get to hunt them.
Because it's kind of like, that's like the redheaded stepchild of hunting in some mm-hmm. ways. At least that's my perception in some ways. is that Colby's smirking a bit. Yeah. Let me I retract the redhead, the stepchild, okay? Colby's
my wife's a redhead too.
And so people might just be like, or that's probably why people that don't hunt over baiter hounds,
because they don't want to fight that battle.
Right. Well, here's the thing. We've got to be quick here so we can end, but if they don't fight that battle with us, we're going to lose. And then the next thing they will get will be something that you're interested in.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, that's kind of like a threat, you know, and I don't want it to come across as like a threat. But the truth is that in 2019, we have given the anti-hunting community as much as we can give them and maintain this beautiful way of life that is creating great stuff for wildlife and habitat all across this continent, unlike man has ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
In modern times, for the amount of civilization we have, for, you know, so it's like, if we want to maintain our way of life, we don't have anything left to give them. And so any legal means of hunting in 2019 ought to be supported by every person on this continent that owns a hunting license, if they want to keep even what they have for future generations
right.
to come.
Right.
So that's part of our message, is like, hey, don't fight against us. Go ahead and join with us. Even if you're never going to hunt with hounds or hunt with bait, it's like, at least understand it. You know, just understand it and know that that is connected to what you do. And so that's my appeal to people, is that we've got to, you know, we really do have to stand together. And I would hope that giving people you know, kind of scripting the narrative for why we do these things makes sense, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what my goal was. I was hoping to provide some dialogue for people like me who maybe don't want to be the reason something gets taken away, because we didn't understand it and we didn't fight for it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think we sit in a really unique position as bear hunters in the modern times. I really do. Like, I mean, I feel like it's like a call. I believe that bears are going to be the gateway to the hunting community. And so if we guard that gate, they're never going to get anything else. It's a good way
It's a good way to look at it. Yeah. I like it.
Guard the gate.
Yeah.
Because we're right there. I mean, and we probably see that here more than just the average bear hunter right. out there that's baiting bear in Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't know that there is a massive war going on. And it's true, and we see it here, and there's legislation. We've had Sportsman's Alliance on here, and, I mean, there's legislation all over the place about bear hunting.
Right.
And so, man, we just have to keep creating that narrative, educating people, giving people the words to say, giving them the information, the knowledge, but also the heart posture. Like, we're not just saying that we have all the answers and that this way is the best way. But there's like a human appeal to it as well. To me, it's just like, man, this is a fantastic way of life. You know,
it's a lot easier to throw rocks at somebody who's on the other side of the wall and you can't see them.
Yeah.
But you make those personal connections with people. It's like, right. Look, I like to hunt bears. I like to feed my family. I like, you know, we have a lot more in common than we do not in common.
Right.
And so right. we have to be that friendly face, so right. to speak. I think you guys are doing a great job of it.
Well, passionate authenticity.
Right.
You know, the authenticity means, I think, that we've got to have the knowledge. We've got to have the science. We've got to have this foundational stuff like we've talked about. But we've also got to be doing it for the right reasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not trying to poke a stick in some anti-hunter's eye or somebody else's eye that doesn't like bear hunting. I mean, it's just like, man, this is something that I love. Don't take it away from me. I mean, like, literally.
Yeah.
I mean, to think that my sons would not be able to roll out here on public land in Arkansas and hunt in 25 years. I mean, that's like tragedy.
Scary thought.
It's like tragedy. And so we don't want that to happen. But, man, we've gone over our hour, hadn't we, Colby?
Buck 20.
I swore we wouldn't do it. Well, thanks so much, James, for coming on. Awesome, man.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it very much, and hopefully we made a few points that people hadn't thought about.
Yeah. Well, everybody, check out Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, and also check out, if you're in Arkansas, check out the Arkansas chapter.
That's right.
Well, it's not officially a chapter yet,
but
yeah,
you know, Southeast chapter.
Southeast chapter.
I need to switch over from Texas.
Yeah, yeah, you need to update your mailing address on the website, and you'll be part of us just like that.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, keep the wild places wild, because that's where the bears live.